It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. A new bill in the state legislature would require the state to recommend that anyone charged with a new crime while under extended supervision, parole, or probation go back to prison. If approved, the Department of Corrections estimates it could substantially increase the state's prison population. Republican Assembly Representative Brent Jacobson is a sponsor of the bill. He represents a central Wisconsin district that includes parts of Marathon, Waupaca, Portage, and Shawnee counties. Representative Jacobson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, I want you to spell out, if you will, what this bill does, because I'll admit the procedure is a little complicated. I read it wrong at first. What exactly does this bill do?
Sure. So what this bill does, it's really a small bill in terms of the amount of text with the bills that we see. So the change it makes is, right now, if somebody is out on supervision, extended supervision, parole, or probation, and they commit another crime, or at least are charged with committing another crime while they're out, it's entirely up to the Department of Corrections officer assigned to that case to determine whether or not to recommend that this individual go back to serve out the length of the sentence for the crime they're already convicted of. What this bill does is it mandates that the DOC agent make those recommendations when another crime's been committed, or someone's charged with committing another crime while they're out. Now, this individual still, you know, gets due process because it's a recommendation by DOC, but ultimately an administrative law judge will determine whether that individual will go back into the system to serve out the length of their sentence.
Right. And I want to spell out specifically a couple things the bill doesn't do. It's not that that person charged with a crime is automatically going back to prison. The recommendation would be automatic. And then that goes, as you say, before a judge. Do I have that right?
That's right. And actually, listeners can go out on my website and find the bill is AB 85. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about the state website is you can pull up the fiscal estimate on the bill, which I'm sure you'll have some questions on, but in the fiscal estimate, the Department of Administration assumes actually only in 47%, so less than half of those cases where recommendations have to be made, the ALJ would ultimately send the individual back to serve out the term.
And what is your motivation here? Make the case for this change.
Sure. Well, I came up in local government before joining the legislature, and one of the roles I had in local government was I chaired criminal justice and public safety in Marathon County, which geographically is a very large county. And, you know, I interacted with the court system, the Justice Department, judges, prosecutors, corrections. And you saw these stories again and again of individuals who are out on extended supervision or parole or probation. They're given a second chance, which I entirely support second chances. But when you get to third and fourth and fifth chances, and they're not coming back into the system to serve out their sentence, they're likely to commit additional crimes. And what the fiscal estimate doesn't capture, and it can't because, you know, this would be hard to gather all the research from different counties, but the cost of recidivism, we know it's real. We know it's a significant cost on our, you know, our local criminal justice systems. So, you know, I wanted to bring this bill forward, try and capture some of those cases that are falling through the cracks. And it's just a check and balance on DOC to at least make the recommendation and then have an ALJ take a look at it.
Some of the concerns that have been raised are some people in along the process have said, well, wait a minute, this is somebody who's been charged with a new crime, not convicted of a new crime. They may be innocent of that new crime, certainly until proven guilty. Make the case that even that charge is enough to get that recommendation.
Right. And that's a distinction that we really want to stress with this bill. So when an individual is out on extended supervision, parole, or probation, and they're charged with a new crime, if the ALJ determines they should go back, remember, what they're going back for is they're not going back to serve out a sentence for a crime they've only been charged with and not convicted of. They're going back to serve out the sentence for the crime that they were already convicted of before a jury of their peers. And they are still getting that due process before the ALJ on the crime they're charged with to determine if they should go back. And that factor of being charged with a new crime was a condition of that second chance that they got. And so, you know, the condition of that second chance wasn't, well, if you get convicted of a new crime, you're coming back, or there's a chance you'll come back. The condition that was the deal between the offender and the system, that you're going to get freedom. But if you are charged with a new crime, there's a chance you're coming back.
We're talking to Republican Assembly Representative Brent Jacobson from Central Wisconsin about his new legislation that would change some of the terms, the conditions in which someone is recommended to be revoked, sent back to prison if they violate the terms of their parole. In this case, if they're charged with a new crime, they would have to go back before a judge. Representative Jacobson, concerns raised, more people would end up back in prison. We're already over capacity in our prison system in Wisconsin. Do you worry about the effect of this bill on that overcapacity situation?
Well, I understand that's an argument, but, you know, what we recently saw this week is take a look at the Building Commission, you know, which deadlocked on the governor's $4.3 billion capital budget. And a part of that capital budget, one of the big ticket items, is just shy of $500 million in construction costs, looked at revamping the state's prison system. So I think the governor has an interest in revamping our state prison system. Where there was a missed opportunity in that, and it needs to be revisited, is bringing GOP lawmakers into the conversation. And, you know, this bill, if it's signed into law, and I hope the governor signs it into law, we need to be brought into the conversation about the revamp in the prison system that he wants to move forward with.
You've also mentioned the fiscal estimates, some costs involved here, of course, if people do end up being revoked and ending up in prison. You were making the case earlier that the cost of recidivism we avoid could help balance that out. Can you talk about the pro and cons on the dollar signs here?
Sure. Well, if you look at, first of all, the one thing that's interesting in the fiscal estimate is I think it speaks to the fact that there actually is a problem out there, because the fiscal estimate indicates that in 47% of these cases that aren't being recommended, there's a likelihood the ALJ is going to send them back. So we know that there's a substantial number of cases out there where people should be going back after they go before an ALJ. Now, in terms of the fiscal estimate going forward, obviously everything comes with a price tag. But I will say this. Not only the revamp of the prison system I just highlighted, but the governor has expressed, obviously, that we do have, criminal justice and public safety issues in the state. He started right off this session wanting to create and then now continue to fund an Office of Violence Prevention. This is a great way through this bill to try and make our communities safer. And I did highlight that cost of recidivism. If you go into any, you know, local law enforcement department, county, city, village, they'll talk to you about that cost of recidivism. It's a cost on our society and then on our system as well, because you're going through the whole process again of prosecution, investigation, trial, incarceration. And, that's a substantial price tag compared to what we're looking at for an ongoing cost to carry this bill forward.
Are there other priorities on your plate when it comes to the corrections system and criminal justice in Wisconsin?
So I serve on the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee, and we're moving some other bills forward at this time. One of them is going to be coming up for a public hearing here soon. That's creating some additional crimes for people that enter a home with intent to commit a battery. We've got some loopholes in the current statute. And then we also did pick out some specific crimes in AB 66 that also passed the assembly. That takes away some discretion of the prosecutor, or at least another check and balance on the prosecutor for some very serious crimes. It does not allow deferred prosecution agreements on those specific crimes. And also, if the prosecutor wants to dismiss or amend a charge, they'll need to get court approval. That also passed the assembly with AB 85. My colleague, Senator Hutton, is my partner on these bills, and we're going to have some hearings over in the Senate coming up this week, including on AB 85.
I want to switch gears for our last minute or so, Representative Jacobson. We've talked to a couple first-term lawmakers. You are one of them. Just wanted to get your impression on serving in the legislature, how Democrats and Republicans talk to each other, work together, or don't.
Sure. You see a lot of debate on the floor, but, you know, we've got an interesting freshman class. It was great meeting so many new people, regardless of whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. And, you know, I just enjoy having some of those conversations with people on the other side of the aisle. And it may not be about specific legislation. It's just as, you know, kind of moral support as you're getting into your first term. How's it going for you? What are you finding helpful? I just had one of those conversations earlier this week with a fellow freshman who's a Democrat. So you have to maintain a cordial relationship, even if you don't agree on certain policies or bills. And so far, so well. I enjoy having a bigger freshman class, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, because it's a chance to, you know, talk about how things are going and work together to make sure you're keeping your head on straight and enjoying the job you came down there to do.
Representative Jacobson, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. That's Representative Brent Jacobson in the Wisconsin State Assembly for District 87 in central and a little bit of northern Wisconsin. He talked to us about a bill he introduced that would change part of the process for revocation of parole or probation or extended supervision. Do you have questions about how those systems work under our current law or possible changes? Let us know what's on your mind, what you're wondering about, maybe your experience with it in any part of the legal system. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, new report cards are out for hundreds of drinking water utilities across the state.
Drinking water is essential. It keeps us all alive. It sustains our civilization. But most people know very little about the systems themselves or the organizations that run them.
The Wisconsin Water Works Excellence Project, that's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin has more public drinking water systems than anywhere else in the nation. It's also the birthplace of the first Public Service Commission, which was established in 1907. It laid the groundwork for how public utilities operate across the country. Now, more than a century later, researchers at UW-Madison are evaluating the water utilities around the state and assigning letter grades. The Wisconsin Water Works Excellent Project released its report card this week, giving grades to 572 drinking water utilities around Wisconsin. Manny Teodoro is professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, where he leads the Wisconsin Water Works Excellent Project. He spoke with Kate Archer-Kent last week.
So lay it out for us. What is the Wisconsin Water Works Excellent Project, which is the first public report, I understand?
Yeah, it is an effort to publish comprehensive academic-style report cards for every regulated drinking water utility in the state of Wisconsin. That's 570 utilities, and we're producing a report card, the same kind of thing that you would have had in high school. There's different subjects, and you get a grade, A, B, C, D, F. It's an effort to help illuminate these often forgotten and hidden but critical systems.
Okay, so these are the report cards coming out. What do you want these report cards to accomplish?
You know, it's really an effort to make the invisible visible. Drinking water is essential. It keeps us all alive. It sustains our civilization. But most people know very little about the systems themselves or the organizations that run them. And so people tend to forget about them. we notice when we have to pay a bill every month or maybe every couple of months or every quarter. But, you know, a water system that's in great shape, a water utility that's operating very efficiently, looks exactly the same as one that's on the verge of disaster the day before the disaster. So what we're trying to do is show to residents, policymakers, that these things are important and try to get them on folks' minds and their radar screens before those disasters occur. And so that's one of the things we're trying to do. The other thing we're trying to do is help distinguish great water systems from merely good ones or merely adequate ones. You know, the whole water sector is sort of organized around this framework of regulatory compliance. My goal as a utility manager, of course, is to comply with regulations. But that's sort of doing the minimum. You can think of that in academic terms as taking a course pass-fail. Well, pass-fail is fine. It's good to pass. It's bad to fail. But a pass-fail approach doesn't distinguish the truly great student, that honors student, from the merely barely passing student. So what we're trying to do with these report cards is give people a way to distinguish great performance from merely adequate.
And this is not the type of thing that gets unveiled that often. Like, you don't see those differences very visibly. Like, there is not a federal type of report card.
Well, that's correct. This is an unprecedented report card. Like, there's nobody else in the country that's done anything like this. The closest is there's a couple of efforts. There's one in New Jersey, and there's one in Louisiana that have public reporting of utility performance, but they don't provide this summary academic style report card. So there's just a lot of data in the case of New Jersey. In the case of Louisiana, there is an academic style report card, but it's not broken down by subject. And honestly, it's pretty easy to earn an A under that Louisiana rubric. Not so here in Wisconsin. Our rubric is quite rigorous. It's actually very difficult to earn an A. So in that sense, it's unique. And it's something that you can only do here in this state because of the depth and quality of data we have on water system performance.
I was going to say, how did you pull this data and how do you know that what you have is helpful to be able to put out these clear report cards?
Yeah, you could not do this in any other state. And that's because we have a couple of institutions, organizations in the state that collect massive amounts of high quality data on water system performance. There's the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So DNR captures water quality data for all of these systems. They take thousands and thousands of water samples every year, and we've got data on all of that water quality. But the really unique thing in Wisconsin is our Public Service Commission. So the PSC keeps infrastructure quality and financial data on all of these systems as well. And that just doesn't exist in any other state. We have extraordinarily fine-grained data going back decades for all of these systems. So that allows us to evaluate the systems in a way that would just be practically impossible anywhere else.
About how many Wisconsinites get their tap water from a water utility versus a well?
Right. It's about two-thirds of our population. Roughly two-thirds of our population gets their water from a utility. And in Wisconsin, those are almost all municipal utilities. We have 50 or 60 special districts. There's one investor-owned utility, but most of us get it from a municipal government. The roughly one-third of Wisconsinites who get their water from a private well, you know, that's a very large proportion relative to most states. So we have a lot of folks who are on private wells, even when they are close to or even within municipalities. A lot of our residents get their water from private wells. And we aren't issuing report cards for private wells. So we don't have the data to do that.
We recently visited a resident of French Island, Jim Boyson, who has been drinking bottled water for more than 4 years after learning about PFAS contamination in his tap water. And let's take a listen.
When you think about water, well, you don't actually think about it every day. How often do you think about your water? Never. You know, it's just turn the tap on, it's automatically there. Not anymore.
Not anymore. Do we take the quality of our tap water for granted?
We sure do. You know, water, drinking water that comes out of that tap, it's the thing that you never think about until it's the only thing you think about. And we do have, unfortunately, a handful of places in the state, French Island is one of them, where we do have severe drinking water quality problems. Thank goodness that's the exception. But where, you know, where we have severe problems, they are, in some sense, the only thing to think about. You're going to wake up in the morning thinking about drinking water. It is the everyday miracle of the modern era that we have grown up, you know, born and raised in a society where we didn't have to think about these things. For our ancestors, starting from, only, you know, probably about 100 years ago, and before that, the whole history of our species, people had to think about where they were going to get their water. And so when that that potable water system came into people's homes, it was a miracle. But you know, you almost heard in the sound of that man's voice a sense of disappointment and almost betrayal. And that's because drinking water is different from almost everything else government does. It's a deeply, deeply intimate service. We're talking about a government service that comes directly into your home. We immerse our children in it. We cook with it. We take it into our bodies. There's nothing else that government does that's quite like drinking water. So yeah, it carries not just health consequences, environmental consequences, but it means something to people's relationship with the state.
And you study that. You study how water and democracy are intricately connected. Can you tell us more about that trust or that lack of trust in government when a water system goes awry?
Yeah. In 2022, I published a book called The Prophets of Distrust with colleagues at the University of Iowa and University of Missouri, and it was about that relationship. As I said, water is such a critical, essential, it's the most basic of all basic services, and when it fails, people lose trust in the entire edifice of the regulatory system, the municipal utilities that are supposed to bring it. And the really troubling thing, Kate, is your drinking water system could be perfectly fine, could be excellent. But if you read about a failure in a neighboring community, or maybe even a community across the country, a Flint, Michigan, a Jackson, Mississippi, you're going to hear that news, and it's going to make you question your own tap water, even if your tap water is fine. So that's part of what we're trying to do with these report cards as well. In fact, at the end of the book, we sort of speculate that, hey, maybe report cards would help illuminate this a little bit and help people distinguish the good systems from the bad and the great systems from the good.
So they wouldn't automatically go to the grocery store with their jugs if they don't need to and to spend that money.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, bottled water or even the water from those vending machines in the supermarket, those are orders of magnitude more expensive than tap water. For the most part, Americans are paying about a penny a gallon for tap water. A penny a gallon. If you buy water, bottled water by the case, maybe you buy cheap stuff at Walmart or Target or something, that's going to be something like 85 cents to a dollar per gallon. If you're buying the fancier kind, it can push $2 per gallon, or even absurdly more than that. If you buy it out of a vending machine, it's probably going to be something like 35 to 50 cents a gallon. So we're talking a lot more money. If people can get so that they're comfortable with their tap water, we're going to save a lot of money.
We're talking about the new Wisconsin Water Report Card grades 572 water utilities around the state. Manny Teodoro is a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison and founder of the Wisconsin Waterworks Excellence Project. Manny, digging into the grades here, some good news. More than 90% of Wisconsin utilities earn A grades in the water quality health category. Why do you think the state performed so well in this category?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on here. One is it's a testament to the commitment of the men and women who operate these systems. They have a real commitment. People who work in the water sector are mostly quite passionate about what they do. So I think that they take it seriously, they take it personally, and that is a real success story. I think it's also no coincidence that water quality is the thing that we measure and report publicly. Right now, you know, people probably have seen these things that come out every year called the consumer confidence reports. Mm-hmm. They're very difficult to read. They're a little bit intimidating. They got a lot of chemical names on them. They're sort of scary. Well, those go out publicly, and you know, I think there's no coincidence there then that the people who operate these systems are aware that those things go out publicly. And so, you know, the thing that we measure and observe, not surprisingly, is the thing where we perform very, very well.
So what about the 41 utilities that failed in that category, water quality, health category? What do you see there?
Yeah, they are mostly In fact, they're almost all cases where a utility violated the Safe Drinking Water Act with what's called a maximum contaminant limit violation or treatment technique violation. Those are situations where the DNR determined that a utility failed to meet the health requirements of the Safe Drinking Water Act. So in rubric, that's an automatic failure.
And so those systems would be in the process of rectifying whatever is going on there?
That's right. And in a lot of cases, they already have.
Okay.
The data in that report are from 2022 and 2023. But yeah, you know, I want to emphasize, Kate, that our rubric is rigorous. You know, you ask my students, they'll tell you I'm tough. I don't inflate those grades. And we don't inflate the grades for our utilities. It is difficult to earn an A. It's not enough to stay under the contaminant limits. You got to stay way under the contaminant limits to earn an A under our rubric. So the fact that over 90% of our utilities get A's, again, that's an extraordinary success story.
The finance grades were much more of a mixed bag across the board. What stood out to you about the affordability of water around the state?
So in most of our state, water is actually pretty affordable. You know, if by affordable we mean the prices are relatively low, there's a strong relationship between the size of the utility and the affordability of the water. Water is a very capital intensive enterprise. Our small towns and municipalities tend to have very high prices for their water. Our bigger systems tend to have lower prices for their water. So affordability is actually not too bad in most of the state, certainly for their larger communities. The finance grades, yeah, they were all over the place. And a lot of that was, especially again, in some of those smaller communities, it's relative financial weakness. A lot of these places are running without much in the way of financial reserve. You know, we just came out of a pandemic where the need for financial reserves became quite glaring for everyone involved. We had utilities that couldn't collect bills for a period of time. Well, you still got to pay for chemicals. You still got to pay for workers. You still have to run your pumps and pay for electricity. So we need those financial reserves to be there. Those were the areas that really stood out as places where we could do better with finance, because we cannot maintain that excellent health grade if we don't have the money.
And you write that mixed grades for infrastructure and operations raises concerns about the sustainability of these critical systems. What was most concerning for looking at these types of results on infrastructure?
Yeah, the infrastructure grades, the thing that really stood out is that only a very small percentage, I think 5 or 10% are getting A's in infrastructure. And we have almost a quarter of our systems in the D to F range. That's a significant minority. What really stands out there is infrastructure condition. Midwestern winters are very, very tough on water distribution systems. It gets cold, cold, cold in the winter. It gets hot in the summer. And those wild fluctuations in temperature cause pipes to leak, and it can cause them to break. People don't realize it, but on the coldest days of the winter here, we've got operator crews in our cities fixing main breaks, middle of the night, dead of winter, they're out there fixing those main breaks to keep our water pressure up. We can't keep those health grades strong with failing infrastructure. You know, main breaks cause disruptions to homes and businesses. Those main breaks can cause loss of water pressure, which can introduce contaminants into the water system. They're bad, bad, bad. So I worry about the sustainability of that strong performance on health if our infrastructure quality isn't where it needs to be.
So if someone looks at these grades and at their own municipal system and has concerns about performance or quality or cost, what is in their power to do as a resident?
Well, like I said, we're fortunate in Wisconsin in the sense that we have so much data available. The institutions to contact or to get involved are the utilities themselves. In Wisconsin, they're almost all municipal systems, so they're owned and operated by municipal governments. They can contact their local municipalities. But we're also unique in Wisconsin in that every one of those municipal systems is also regulated by the Public Service Commission. So you can contact PSC, especially if you think there are problems with infrastructure or on the financial side. That's going to be, you know, the place to get some help, you know, to look to for relief. It's a set of institutions that provide the public opportunities to advocate for more water. It's part of that progressive tradition that we've got in this state. We built institutions to be responsive. We're just trying to help that by putting information into people's hands.
And then I'm wondering, you know, as you look at all of this data, as the grades came in through this process, did anything surprise you along the way as a researcher?
Honestly, I was surprised at how well we did with health. I was expecting strong performance. I wasn't expecting 90% or more getting A's because, as I said, our rubric's tough. I also expected going in that we would see a strong relationship between performance and size. It's very tough to run a modern water system if you've got 2-3 employees. These are technically complex jobs. When the data came out, though, and we really started to see the relationship between performance and size, it was even more dramatic than I expected. So I think one of the big takeaways that people are going to get from these report cards is that a lot of our small communities are doing fine, but a lot of our smaller rural water systems are really struggling. And that's tough. It's tough to operate a water system if you've got a small population, a stagnant population, maybe even a shrinking population, which is true in large swaths of our state. It is, again, a testament to the dedication of the men and women who operate those systems that they're still maintaining health, but they're keeping those systems together, you know, by hook and by crook. So that I think the thing that stands out is we need to find systemic ways to help our smaller systems.
Manny, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. It's been great, and I hope that these report cards help the people of Wisconsin.
That was Manny Teodoro, professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, talking to Kate Archer-Kent. Teodoro is the founder of the Wisconsin Waterworks Excellence Project. They just released a report card grading 572 water utilities around the state. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, meet a Wisconsin researcher working with people in wheelchairs to help make the experience as user-friendly and injury-free as possible.
We really want to keep their arms as healthy as it can be so they can do all the activities that they want to do.
That's next here on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about finding alternatives to alcohol.
There's a shop in Middleton that has rows of bottles, mixes, and cans, but none of them contain alcohol. It's called Sober Social, and it's Wisconsin's first non-alcoholic bottle shop. Producer Morgan D. Stewart caught up with owner Christy Tanner about opening the store and their recovery journeys.
When I ask Christy Tanner to tell me her story, she starts with her divorce, a drinking while driving offense, rehab, and jail.
I was not one of those high-bottom people.
High-bottom people are called that because they're holding down jobs and supporting their families, but they realize they're headed for disaster. They give up their drug of choice before it impacts their lives.
I had a real drinking problem, and I didn't want to get sober. When that happened, I had 4 children under the age of 5 and a half, no twins, and I was about 60 days separated from my husband.
Alcohol did this to Tanner, like it did to me. I, too, had been divorced, been in traffic accidents, and have seen the inside of a jail cell. I hid as much of this as I could from as many people as I could because of the shame and stigma associated with addiction. And like Tanner, even when I hit those bottoms, quitting wasn't an option.
I thought it was going to leave me alone, isolated, left out. I'm not going to have any friends. I'm not going to have anywhere to go, and I'm going to have nothing to do.
It might sound silly to some, but the social aspects that come along with drinking, like going to a bar with friends or celebrating at an event, that weighs heavily on people. For them, sobriety means no more socializing.
People so often feel this guilt and shame about why they can't manage whatever their thing is. I wanted to really destigmatize sobriety. I wanted it to be something that might be attractive, that you might want to try, that would make you feel good. How can we socialize and let it be something that everyone can experience, not just the people who drink?
Tanner opened her new retail store, Sober Social, partially to destigmatize addiction. But she's working to do something more.
Yeah, I can give you a little tour. So we've got these shelves are all sphere.
I want people like myself to feel included and a part of.
Sober Social and this aspect of the sobriety movement are all about inclusion. Tanner recommends one way for existing bartenders and party hosts to help non-drinkers feel like they belong. Offer a variety of elevated beverages that don't have alcohol in them. Not all teetotalers want sugary sodas or bitter teas.
My personal opinion now is if you do not have a non-alcoholic option at your bar, you don't have a full bar service. You should have an NA cocktail, and you should have an NA wine or an NA beer.
Having options can help people avoid that dreaded question.
The question was, why aren't you drinking? And that's not the question that I want to be answering. I want to be talking to my friends about whatever we're talking about, whatever everyone else is, you know, dealing with. When I didn't have something, it always brought it back to what made me different than other people. And I'm like, how can I solve this problem?
Opening a sober business is just one of the ways that's helped Tanner live an engaged and meaningful life 5 years into sobriety. She's also been a recovery and divorce coach. She encourages people who are going through hard times or who want to change to remember that we never know where those rock bottoms will lead us.
Morgan D. Stewart brought us that story on Christy Tanner, who owns a non-alcoholic bottle shop in Middleton. Check out their full conversation on the You Human Creative Recovery podcast. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today. Each day, millions of people use manual wheelchairs to get around. On average, they're turning those wheels more than 1,000 times a day. That constant motion can have a big impact on somebody's shoulders and joints. So how can wheelchairs be improved to better suit the needs of the users? And what movements have the least impact on joints and shoulders? There's not as much research out there on those issues as I might have thought, but more than a decade ago, an engineering professor at UW-Milwaukee started a lab to explore these questions. Today, Brooke Slavens is director of the Mobility Lab in Milwaukee. The goal is to better understand the movements and improvements for manual wheelchairs. Her focus is the human in the chair. Brooke, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
What led you into studying wheelchairs, wheelchair movements, and how it affects the bodies of people who are using wheelchairs?
It's a very prevalent problem. There's over 3.6 million wheelchair users, and over 90% of them use manual chairs. So it's something from a scientific perspective that needs a lot more attention than what it's getting. Some of my first work was with children with orthopedic disabilities, where we first started investigating different assistive technologies for rehabilitation. And we noticed right away that there was more work that needed to uncover better design of devices, as well as helping individuals that are using wheelchairs to be able to preserve their arms for everything they need to do to live a really high quality life.
I'm not a wheelchair user, so I hadn't really thought about this before, but then reading about your work, I'm like, duh, of course, if you're using a manual wheelchair, you're pushing that wheel a lot. You're using a particular set of muscles a lot each and every day. Can you talk about how that can go well or go poorly?
Right. So when propelling your own chair, it's estimated roughly you might push your chair over 1,000 times per day. And when you think of individuals that are using a wheelchair throughout their lifespan, that really adds up fast. So what we're studying is that cumulative trauma that can happen to your shoulders through overuse. You know, your arms weren't intended for a repetitive, high force, high stress type of activity. So by using a chair, it's healthy for your body from an exercise cardiovascular perspective, but it can also lead to a number of secondary musculoskeletal conditions, such as pain of the shoulder, early onset arthritis, and even rotator cuff tears in these individuals. So it's something that we really want to keep individuals healthy and active and in their manual chairs as long as possible. But we also want to keep their arms as healthy as it can be so they can do all the activities that they want to do.
Let's get into the nitty-gritty of your work now. What are you doing to figure out how to best fit a wheelchair and how to use it best to prevent those kind of repetitive motion injuries?
Right. So we're using a combination of motion capture technologies, which is similar to what's done in Hollywood for movies to look at movement and how you're moving. We can combine that with different personalized computer models or computational models to look at loading of the joints to understand how much force is being placed on the shoulder, the elbow, the wrist, hand. And then we can also pair that with imaging. So our team is also deploying ultrasound imaging to look inside of the shoulder to understand what's happening at the musculature level.
We're talking to Brooke Slavens, director of the Mobility Lab at UW-Milwaukee, professor there of mechanical and biomedical engineering, about her work with wheelchair users to help prevent repetitive motion injuries and other problems that can come along with wheelchair use. You've been doing this for over a decade, I understand. What kind of results do you hear from people who maybe have found a new and better way to use this assistive device?
We've been able to provide different feedback to individuals in a couple different ways. One is we've designed different wheels over the years that can help decrease the amount of load where they might have gearing that is instrumented into the wheel, similar to a bicycle. We've also worked to analyze different ways you can move your arms. So similar to how swimmers have different strokes that they use in a pool, we can also train individuals to use different arm patterns or stroke patterns to move in a better way or a different way that might be more personalized to their needs. And then we've also looked at different ways that the wheelchair itself can be configured and how the fit of the chair or the size of the chair can also help improve their efficiency of their movement and how they're getting around. So wheelchair fit is another area that I think a lot of individuals can relate to, where you can have custom seating, custom footrests, armrests, anything that you name, you can really fine tune it to make it fit the way that you need for your body. And with kids especially, this is really important as they change and grow and need to have different changes made to the actual chair itself.
Yeah, I was wondering, does your work go to wheelchair designers or manufacturers to say, hey, here are some things that can make this more customizable or a better fit for people?
At times, we have been able to work closely with different wheelchair companies to provide some new ideas for technology and partner with them. That's something that we would love to continue to help work with to develop new ideas. Same goes for clinical guidelines for care of their shoulder and for their movement, that we would love to get this work to the patients, you know, that want the technology and need to use the technology. So at the end of the day, that's one of the most rewarding aspects of what we do, is being able to get it into the patient's hands.
Something that strikes me here is this can't be a one-size-fits-all solution for everybody. The answers might be different for that 12-year-old kid versus that 60-year-old person, or based on shape and size and reason for needing the wheelchair in the first place. How important is it to customize these solutions to a particular person?
Absolutely. That is exactly correct. And that's some of the driving motivation behind what we're doing in our lab. We're one of the few groups in the world that is looking at pediatric manual wheelchair users. And it's so important because they're changing and growing so fast. And even as adults, as you transition to adulthood and even, age, you know, there can be changes that need to happen, and changes not only in growth and skeletal maturation, but just changes in your body size and changes in the activities that you do or the places you go. So it's always something that continues to change that requires more of a personalized understanding of the solutions, and also personalized customization of their wheelchairs for the users too.
A takeaway, it sounds like to me, for people in wheelchairs, their families, other healthcare providers, I would imagine some people think, well, you're using a wheelchair, there's going to be shoulder pain, end of story. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that way, does it?
Right, exactly. And especially with kids, you know, a lot of the mindset is like, oh, they're young and they're kids, they're not going to have pain or shoulder rotator cuff tears. They probably don't have that. And we're finding that that's actually the opposite case, where we are finding that these early and young individuals do have concerning, you know, tears and other, you know, complex pathology happening in their shoulder, similar to the adults. And it is also, I think, kind of misunderstood in the sense that just because you're using an assistive device, whether that's a wheelchair, walkers, crutches, you shouldn't have to have pain and secondary conditions that result from that. And there are a lot of ways that we can change what those individuals do and how they're using it to be able to prevent such things from occurring.
Brooke, thanks for joining us, and thanks for sharing your research with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Brooke Slavens is the director of the Mobility Lab at UW-Milwaukee and professor of mechanical and biomedical engineering. The goal of the Mobility Lab is to better understand the movements of manual wheelchairs to improve the experience for the people who use them. If you like birds and you like counting things, there's a big event coming up just for you. The Midwest Crane Count brings together volunteers in Wisconsin and beyond to help get a picture of sandhill crane and whooping crane populations in seven states. We'll hear from a big fan of cranes as that event gets closer. In the meantime, we want to hear from you. Have you participated in this crane count before? Are you planning to this year? And in general, are you excited about the return of migratory birds this time of year? What are you on the lookout for? Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.